My name is Maya Hasegawa. I'm 16 years old. Today is December 26, 2018. I'm speaking with Tamar Slobodkin, who is my piano teacher. We're recording this interview in Setauket, New York. So you're someone I respect and look up to in life, and I've known you for the majority of my life. So I'm glad we could take this opportunity to share this with the future.
That's very nice what you said. That's very sweet.
As an opener, can you tell me in general about the things you've done or things you've achieved or been involved in throughout your life that you consider important to you?
There probably are three stages of my life. Of course, it began with always an interest in music.
Mm-hmm.
I came from a musical family. But the other was, it was a family, and I was always very concerned with political action. The way one treats people, it's now called civil rights, but that was always a very important part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the one advice my father used to give us is don't just take up space.
Mm-hmm.
Do something every day to make the world better. So those were the two early things in my life. And I married young,
mm-hmm.
became very active at universities where we lived. And music, although I don't have a formal degree in music,
mm-hmm.
I was able to study with very fine teachers throughout my life,
mm-hmm.
and became a chamber music performer for
mm-hmm.
20 some odd years,
mm-hmm.
but always had a teaching studio. It's just in the last 10 years it's become more involved as I stopped performing more.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most significant things that I ever did was at the University of Michigan,
mm-hmm.
where we first lived. We, a group of people, fought very hard for what was called an open speaker platform. Which meant that students would be able to invite controversial people to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that was a very important thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the university agreed. And then the very first person that the students invited
mm-hmm.
was the head of the Nazi Party in America, which did not thrill me very much. However, I couldn't very well say,
mm-hmm.
don't come,
yeah.
having just arranged
mm-hmm.
for that. So what we did decide to do is to use his speech. We did limit what he could do. He could not come in uniform. He
right.
could not carry guns.
Right.
So we did limit that. But we decided we would raise money for Freedom Riders. And we had a banner which said, genocide is not controversial. And everyone who was involved
mm-hmm.
wore that banner.
Right.
And it also was in front of the lecture hall.
Mm-hmm.
We arranged a huge, huge picket line
mm-hmm.
That would be there before he spoke. He had to go through it. I told everybody they're not to get arrested for walking on the grass. If they're going to get arrested for other reasons, but not for walking on the grass. And we created the first, what we called a bucket drive. Teams of personnel, mostly students and faculty, went throughout the entire city of Ann Arbor, using the armbands of genocide is not controversial, explaining what we were doing, and collecting money in buckets. And in the end, we raised well over $5,000, which was sent down to the Freedom Riders. The other thing we did was, when he was speaking, we arranged for groups of 25 people at a time would simply get up quietly and walk out of the hall. 5 minutes later, another group would simply get up, quietly go out. After the third group left, he was beside himself. He was just so furious. He was ranting and ranting. And it achieved what a more violent approach would have not achieved. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's one of the most important things that I feel that I did politically. Mm-hmm. As far as musically, I did love performing chamber music. There's mm-hmm. no question about it. It's my first love. And teaching. Mm-hmm. I've had the privilege of working with you, who's so gifted, so involved with music, and I've had a number of other students that way. And I look forward to every day of my teaching, mm-hmm. every single day.
I can tell.
That's lovely.
Did you always know you were going to be a teacher?
Always. And not necessarily a teacher, but a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Always, yeah. From the time I was a child. Mm-hmm. It was music and maybe a veterinarian, or music, maybe an instantaneous French translator at the UN until I discovered that there are French speakers who probably would be better at it. I did love the French language and mm-hmm. literature,
yeah.
But it was always music.
Yeah.
It was always music.
Mm-hmm. When did you decide to be a teacher?
That's a very good question, because I did not want to be just the teacher next door.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have something special to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And I was introduced to the work of Dorothy Taubman
mm-hmm.
Some 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her work that I knew I wanted to be able to give to my students.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it works.
Yeah,
her
it
approach
does.
Works.
Mm-hmm.
And it is reasonable, and one doesn't. There's so many musicians who have been injured.
Right.
And she started her work partly because of retraining
right.
re-injured or injured students.
Mm-hmm.
So why not teach from the beginning yeah. so that you don't get injured?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I knew immediately I had something special I wanted to teach.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at how technology has advanced so quickly, it's obvious to say that kids growing up back then have much different childhoods than we do now. Apart from like glaring, obvious changes, what small things or things people might not think about, what were the changes, or how was your childhood different?
Oh, my childhood was very different because I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, mm-hmm. college town, and did the usual things from September to the middle of June.
Mm-hmm.
But then my family owned a farm. About a half an hour outside of New Haven.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting at the farm was that it had no running water.
Oh.
It had no electricity.
Mm-hmm.
My father was very clever with his hands, although he was a professional veterinarian. Very clever. So I basically was living during the summer the life of the little house on the prairie.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's basically what it was.
Yeah.
I had two older brothers.
Mm-hmm.
We did all kinds of handicraft things.
Mm-hmm.
We even made our own bows and arrows. They were very hard to use because we weren't too good at it. But I did learn how to put feathers on an arrow, which is a very tricky thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we raised, it was during the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
We raised all the vegetables that we ate during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
My mother and I would can them, process them. And I was expected to work in the garden. It was a large garden,
mm-hmm.
With also had a lot of fruit trees.
Mm-hmm.
I was expected to put in 1 or 2 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
even though I was only 7, 8 years
wow.
old.
Mm-hmm.
My older brothers put in 4 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
With my father. I loved it because it was a way I could be with my father,
mm-hmm.
and I could, in a sense, compete with my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
They hated it. And both of them, as soon as they got out of high school and college, they went to sailboats. And I don't think ever cut grass again. But I still love to garden.
Yeah.
And
your garden's beautiful.
Yes, I have both the vegetable garden,
yeah.
and then I also have flower gardens,
mm-hmm.
now.
Yeah.
But that was a very, very different life.
Yeah.
I still, I remember trimming the wicks of the oil lamps,
mm-hmm.
that
wow.
we had.
Uh-huh.
I had to chop wood for the wood stove.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my job in the morning,
mm-hmm.
To bring in the wood to start the fire,
mm-hmm.
in the stove,
mm-hmm.
which... Sometimes if you see pictures of the 19th century farmhouses,
mm-hmm.
you will see these old big stoves,
mm-hmm.
that you have to lift the cover off the stove and put wood
yeah.
into them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was my job.
Wow.
And so it was an interesting
yeah.
life.
Especially since you live, that was during World War II.
That was World War II.
Wow.
That was, of course, another whole aspect of my life, because
mm-hmm.
My father's family was still in Europe,
right.
and many of them were lost.
Uh-huh.
So
right.
our dinner conversation from the time I was, what I remember clearly was from the time I was 6 to 10,
mm-hmm.
Was, have we heard anything
right.
about so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a time my father had a very strong accent, and
mm-hmm.
I suppose people confused his accent with
mm-hmm.
who he was.
Mm-hmm.
But there were many, many times when my brothers and I had to wash swastikas off the sidewalk in front of his veterinary hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very sad.
Right.
That was very sad.
Yeah.
Because he loved and respected America.
Yes.
I'm not sure he ever felt completely at home in America.
Yes.
But he felt humiliated.
Yes.
By those swastikas,
right.
and that was a difficult period.
I believe my dad had a similar experience after 9/11.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yes.
I'm sure.
Yes, someone told him in a grocery store to go back to his country.
Yeah.
Yes, and, you know, a
very similar and very painful,
yes.
unfortunate
yeah.
Happening.
Yes. What, in your teaching career, what have you been very proud of?
I think that the I'm proudest of the fact that when people leave the studio,
mm-hmm.
they feel that they can sit down at a new piece of music and know how to read the score
mm-hmm.
accurately. And that means not only just the notes,
mm-hmm.
but to read what is inside
yeah.
the score and inside the music.
Mm-hmm.
And feel that they know how to learn a piece of music on their own
yeah.
without me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I'm proudest of.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing would be that many, many of my students recontact me and say they're still involved with music. Somebody was the accompanist for a local chorale, and somebody else was doing some pit work in a local show.
Mm-hmm.
Just involved in music
yeah.
in some way after their studies.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are a number of students I've had who are now either professional musicians or most of them are teaching.
Mm-hmm.
One is teaching composition in Indonesia, as a matter of fact, and performing. Somebody else is getting the graduate degree in pedagogy. So it's the fact that so many of my students are still involved
yeah.
in music and love
mm-hmm.
what they're doing.
And I hope to be like that. I'm sure.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure yeah. you will. And I hope that you'll get involved more and more with chamber music.
Yeah.
There are organizations all over the country, all over the world,
yeah.
that will put people together
mm-hmm.
who want to do chamber music.
Yeah.
And actually, that's how I started in chamber
oh.
music.
Mm-hmm.
I became a member. Just a friend of mine was a member,
mm-hmm.
and he encouraged me to join.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't doing it professionally at the time,
mm-hmm.
but it became definitely my first
mm-hmm.
love.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know that your culture is very important to you.
Yes.
How has that shaped you living in America and just as a person?
Well, I grew up with a very, very strong Zionist background.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of things. For one thing, my mother worked,
mm-hmm.
which was very unusual at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Not many women did work, and she had two different kinds of jobs. She was raised, again, with a Zionist family, but
mm-hmm.
raised in England. Uh-huh. They just took 18 years to get from Russia to America. So she was born and raised in England,
mm-hmm.
trained as a secretary, and a professional speaker.
Oh.
She had a beautiful, beautiful voice, both
mm-hmm.
singing and speaking voice. And so she used those two skills. She was an office administrator for my
mm-hmm.
Father's veterinary hospital, but also was a lecturer for Hadassah organization
mm-hmm.
and for the Zionist Organization of America.
Mm-hmm.
And she would have speaking tours up and down the East Coast
mm-hmm.
of America. So I grew up with a very strong sense of strong women.
Right.
I was never given a middle name because it was assumed I would keep my maiden name as part of my name,
right.
which I did for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just became too long to say Tamara Jonas Slobodkin every
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely with a very strong sense of I could do whatever I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I still am very influenced, although I would say I have a strong spiritual
yes.
inner sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I am not very good at organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I disassociate from mm-hmm. it is just not something that I feel the need mm-hmm. for.
I think I relate to that.
But on the sense of cultural
yeah.
Judaism, mm-hmm. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, as you know, at all the Jewish holidays, I give out different treats that are associated with the holidays, and that's mm-hmm. something that everybody
yes.
remembers also, along with their music.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very lucky. My husband was invited to travel
yes.
all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
We spent several years living in Israel. That
mm-hmm.
certainly had a very profound effect. I've always worked for a two-state solution in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting less and less secure in that
yeah.
will ever be achieved,
right.
but I will certainly keep trying.
Right.
But those are the forces that
yes.
that govern my right. my life. As my father says, I try not just to take up space.
Yes. So they supported you in all, of course, your career music
yes.
as well.
Yes. Actually, there's a funny story. I was very active against the Vietnam War
mm-hmm.
when we lived in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
And there was was a member of a group called Women's Strike for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the time of the HUAC investigation.
Right.
And the head of Women's Strike for Peace was called before the committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the group was involved in how should we handle this. HUAC's position was that we were a bunch of women who were not very bright and not very sophisticated, and
right.
we were really being duped by the communists.
Right.
And we felt quite otherwise
mm-hmm.
and very competent and against what was going on. So it was decided that for the first time in the history of the organization, of HUAC,
mm-hmm.
that we would have volunteer witnesses. Now, what that meant, the rules of HUAC were that if you gave any information other than your name,
right.
and you refused to answer questions, you could be cited for contempt of Congress.
Right.
But our intention was that we would be more than happy, each individual person would
right.
be happy to talk about their own personal reasons
right.
for being against the war,
mm-hmm.
but would not under any circumstances talk about anyone else who was in the group
right.
or that had similar feelings. These were personal. Well, that meant that should the committee wish, they could cite us for contempt. So we decided, those members in Ann Arbor decided who might be able to go to jail and who would take care of their kids and who would do this and who would do that. And I felt that, and my husband was totally in agreement,
mm-hmm.
that we would be able to, our kids were old enough, we would be able to manage,
right.
and I said that I would be a volunteer witness
right.
and went off to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But we felt I should notify our various parents. And I called my parents and said, this is the circumstance, you should know that there's this possibility. And they said, we understand,
mm-hmm.
fine. And we called my husband's family, who was far less political,
right.
Actually quite apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
And we told my mother-in-law that, you know, I was a volunteer witness before HUAC, and she said, HUAC, oh, I know them. They're not nice. I'll bring you chicken soup. So, it became a very good family story. And in the end, of course, the committee did not call one single volunteer witness. Mm-hmm. They were so shocked that a group of people would come and volunteer to talk to them. Right. It was the beginning of the end of UOC. It ended very shortly after that. They were a horrible, horrible committee and destroyed many, many lives.
Yes.
For no reason, for absolutely no reason.
Yeah.
But I felt that I had my part in ending them.
Yes. You mentioned traveling with your husband.
Oh, yes.
What are some notable experiences that you've had?
Oh, well, as I mentioned before, my husband had several Fulbright scholarships, several other scholarships that allowed us, a Guggenheim fellowship, that allowed us to go to different countries for long periods of time. We went to Israel twice, 1961, 1966, 67. And when we traveled with our children, rather than try to go to 10 different places en route, we decided we would just select a few places and let the children be involved in the whole tourist activity. We had a wonderful trip in Italy, in France. My daughter Naomi was 4 years old when we were in Italy, and we took a horse-drawn cab around some of the cities, and the driver had brought her right up to sit next to him and help him guide the horses. She never forgot that as long as she lived.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly all the trips to Spain, to Italy rather, were very special.
Mm-hmm.
We also went, but without the children, just Larry and me, went to Hungary and Czechoslovakia, which were under the Soviet regime at that time. Very interesting experiences because, as Americans, we were very suspect, but my husband was invited by the Hungarian Academy of Science.
Right.
So we had minders. Someone was with us all the time.
Right.
But still, he was able to go to his meetings to do some research.
Mm-hmm.
When we met with other scientists, they invited us to their homes in many occasions. We would start talking. And after about a half an hour, almost under every circumstance, the windows started to be closed. And the conversation changed more and more to reality rather than banality. And that was a very interesting experience, that even people who were of the same intellectual concerns of my husband felt very, very restrained at first until they sort of sounded out his feelings, my feelings.
Right.
And we were, by the same token, careful of what we said also.
Mm-hmm.
We also, the children were with us when we went to visit a former postdoc of my husband's in Poland.
Oh.
And that was an especially wonderful trip.
Mm-hmm.
We were very fond of him and his wife, and we went hiking in the Tatra Mountains, which was a very, very interesting experience. But also since my father was from Poland, from an area called Galicia. Mm-hmm. It had really no boundaries. He had no passport really till he was 12, 13 years old, because the boundaries kept changing all the time. And he knew this friend of ours, Adam, and we told my father that we were going to Poland. He was very frightened about the idea that we were going back to Poland. He had very bad memories of Poland. But we were going to go, and that was the end. And I asked him, have you no desire at all to go to Poland, because you've talked about how beautiful it is? And he said, no, but I wouldn't mind flying over to see, remind himself how beautiful. But he was frightened of our going. But it was a wonderful trip. Mm-hmm. Since we were there, and it was after the war, I decided I wanted to go to the Warsaw Ghetto. Mm-hmm. To say prayers for my family who was lost.
Yes.
Still painful to think of. Larry did not want to go.
Right.
But Adam, our friend, said that he would go with me. And it was an extraordinary experience, because I took one look at the sign, Arbeit macht frei, which is work means freedom, mm-hmm. that is the front of the ghetto. And I couldn't walk. I had absolute total paralysis. I just stood there and told Adam, I can't move. Mm-hmm. And he absolutely insisted that I start walking, and that we go under the gate and into the museum, which was a very, very, very difficult thing. I was absolutely sure that I would never walk out. You know, like most people of my generation, I'd seen photographs of the ghetto. But it's nothing to be confronted with. It is different.
Right.
And just as an extra difficulty, mm-hmm. We walked into the museum and went into the first room and were looking at documents. And right in the first case, there's the name of my uncle. And I screamed and ran across the room. I mean, it was just a spontaneous kind of fright. Mm-hmm. And then walked back and made sure, yes, and there was no question. That's whose documents it was. So that was, you know, that's part of also living history. But for the most part, our trips were wonderful and glorious and very, very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Since we have a few minutes left, perhaps two more questions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is a regret that you may have in your life, or do you have any?
That's an interesting question. I really don't have regrets. Somehow regrets to me mean that you have stopped moving forward. And I have always tried to move forward in my life. I can't think of any anything I would call a regret.
Yeah.
No.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I've led a wonderful, exciting, meaningful life. And what more can I ask for?
Yeah. That's all anyone wants. I suppose this can be the last question. What are some of the most important lessons you've learned in life?
To put one foot in front of the other. Despite adversities, certainly losing my daughter, it was very difficult.
Yes.
And yet one has to continue.
Yes.
And you do that by putting one step, one foot in front of the other. And there, I think that was the most difficult. I had a wonderful, wonderful long marriage with my husband, and I was even when he became ill, we still managed to do all kinds of things.
Right.
I learned to swing a wheelchair into a station wagon, and we would go off every weekend to museums or to something special. So I think that his death was more just a passage of time. It was inevitable, but it was as easy as could possibly be imagined.
Mm-hmm.
But the lessons are that you just have to keep going.
Yes.
And luckily, I always had wonderful students that I could continue teaching. And that helped me a great, great deal. You were always wonderful to me.
Thank you. And I could see that music has been... I remember, I didn't listen to the voicemail of when Naomi passed, but my dad told me that when he called you to and you said, oh, you start talking about my lesson next week, and my dad said, you don't need to give Maya a lesson at this difficult time, and you said, music is what keeps me alive.
Yes, and yes, absolutely. I would have been in big trouble, I think, if I had not had such a wonderful class of students, and you were especially kind to me and supportive. That's, I guess, the right word, supportive during the difficult times.
I'm touched to hear that.
I'm very grateful. And now we can celebrate the happy times.
Yes. This has been so insightful, and I'm glad we got to do this.
I am too. I am very, very glad. I've never done this kind of thing.
I'd like to thank you for doing this. I never thought about doing something like this, but I'm glad we did it.
Yes, I am too.
Yes.